And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. You may be wondering about Phil Conlon. He's going to come in when he can come in, but he has a lot of duties, responsibilities, and he has a show Wednesdays 6 to 8, Classical Underground. And today on the show, we're going to be talking to Glenn Ford, executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, that'll be at about the halfway point, and we're going to probably be speaking shortly with Robin Philpott about the meeting in Addis Ababa of the African Union. They had a heck of a weekend, and we're going to tell you about that. But I want to tell you also that tomorrow, Tuesday, at 7 p.m., that's February 2nd, 7 p.m., there is going to be two talks given under the title Crimes of Empire, Why is the Middle East the Way That It Is? And they'll be headlined by, how about that for a word, Zafar Bengash, who's been on this program, and I'm going to be speaking as well. And it's going to be at 24 Main Street, West Hamilton, Zafar Bengash, Phil Taylor, Crimes of Empire, Why is the Middle East the Way That It Is? And we hope that our friends can make it, and anybody interested in that topic, and they should be. The federal government talks about it. Everybody's wondering about whether or not our new prime minister will be using warplanes again in Syria, or whether he's going to also withdraw the use of the planes from Iraq. Those are all burning questions. And we're joined now, though, I believe, by Robin Philpott. Are you there, sir?
Hi, Phil.
Robin, there has been an important meeting of the African Union. The world's eyes were on it for once, and they talked about the issue of Burundi. There's been a kind of an artificial crisis involving Burundi, and in December, a decision was taken rather abruptly by somebody, the executive of the African Union, I guess, that they were going to send troops, so-called peacekeeping troops, to Burundi, but Burundi indicated they didn't like the idea, so that led to this meeting. And you've interviewed someone today, I understand, who from Burundi. Who was that, and what did he have to say about that meeting?
Yeah, it was. I interviewed for my radio program in French. It was the spokesperson for the president of Burundi. His name is Willy Niyamitwe. I wanted him to. I asked him if he would like to speak about this meeting and important decision, and he immediately was very willing to do so. For Burundi, it's a big victory. That's how he thought. But he points out that the decision was made to send troops in. It was done in a very cavalier fashion, very quickly, with very little.
That was the previous decision in December.
Yeah, back in December, to send 5,000 troops into Burundi. And the Burundian government and the president said, there's no way you're not coming into. We will treat it as an invasion. And we have the forces necessary to protect our people. We do not want it in here. And so he also pointed out that decision was a way of what he said. It basically, and I'm trying to quote as closely as I can, complete the putsch that was attempted last May. In other words, bringing in African Union troops who would, in fact, effectively complete what they were unable to do last May, which is overthrow the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said it was a real victory for democracy, mm-hmm. and respected the people of Burundi, their government, and the sovereignty of Burundi. He also said that the debate took quite a long time, for 5 hours, but that it was a decision which the heads of state reflected on deeply, mm-hmm. And came out with his position. And he pointed out another thing which is interesting. He said Burundi was elected to the African Union Peace and Security Council, who had made this decision to send troops in. And it's in the constitution of this Peace and Security Council and the African Union that they cannot send troops to any member of the Peace and Security Council. So it's a very solid decision.
Well, by the way, apropos of what you're just telling us, that they this idea of my memory is that U.S. State Department and Western media centers had already moved on in their thinking of what should happen, and they were suggesting that perhaps at this meeting Burundi would actually be excluded from membership. You know, there is, my understanding is, I think Eritrea is not a member, and they have certain, you know, states that they have been alienated, and so the Reuters, New York Times, others were hinting that Burundi was in the doghouse and that they might actually be asked to step out, you know, delegitimize them. So this is quite the reverse.
Yeah. No, they were, he said, people in Burundi are very, very happy with the decision. They were, they feel they've been vindicated in defending their rights to sovereignty and also their statements and their successful fight against ethnic, internal ethnic killing. Which had been a problem, has been a serious problem since under the previous governments, Buyoya in the 90s and up until they reached the agreement, which led to the election of the current president. Mm-hmm. I asked them also, and maybe your listeners have heard about this, that Amnesty came out with a, I would call it a propaganda stunt, but they came out and were promoting satellite photos, which they claimed located mass graves in Burundi, and he said that this was basically a propaganda stunt. But he said that each time there's a crucial meeting of the African Union or the Security Council or international events, Human Rights Watch or the Amnesty come out with these pictures, which prove absolutely nothing. And he said that you cannot tell with satellite photos what is underground. You know, you cannot say that there are graves under the ground. You can't say it. But then he asked, he said, if they have such good satellite photos, why don't they show Burundian refugees being trained on Rwandan territory to attack Burundi? Which is a very interesting point. And I also asked him about the arrest of two journalists the last Thursday, I think, or Friday, Thursday, in Bujumbura. There was a journalist, a reporter from Le Monde, and a photojournalist. And he said, yes, he said, as an ex-journalist, it's always a problem. But, he said, the photojournalist was in a place where there was a cache of weapons, including Kalashnikov pistols. And when the police came to that place, the photojournalists ran with those people, ran away with the people who were from that place where the weapons were. So he was stopped with the other people, arrested.
Yeah.
But then he was let off shortly thereafter. And then the reporter from Le Monde went to the same place. And so he was arrested, but immediately released shortly thereafter. So, it, in other words, he tried to point out that with the number, with the when you have people throwing grenades into public places and making armed attacks on the Burundian territory, the police has every right to go in and arrest them.
No, obviously. And by the way, I'm glad that you raised this because I did read an account by one of the international press bureaus of an interview with a man in Burundi who was holding a gun during the interview. So, you know, if the army arrives, they don't say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting your interview. They say, we came for the guy here who has the gun. And you don't get to say, you know, well, I'm from Reuters, I'm going to talk to him. No, you go into prison, you can talk to him. Part of this, and I'm so – it's all apropos, by the way, of Black History Month. See, we're hearing from you the actual statement of a designated official of the Burundian government of their point of view on these matters.
Right.
But in the U.S., by the way, all the reporters stand at attention and listen with their mouths hanging open to anything the State Department says or the presidential spokesman says, and that's their gospel. They don't go down to Burundi and say – well, by the way, our president claims. What do you say? No, that's
yeah.
It's considered. You don't ask the African leader what you just presume he's a criminal,
right.
And this is where, to my opinion, foreign policy is domestic policy.
Yeah,
you know, the people of Flint ought to identify with the people of Burundi.
Exactly. I also asked them, and the last question was. You know, there is the trial, the ICC trial of Laurent Gbagbo, who was the former president of the Ivory Coast. And I asked him, Mr. Niamitwe, about the decision of, or the resolution of the African Union to withdraw from the ICC. And he said that, absolutely said, we are convinced that the ICC is only going after Africans. It's quite obvious. So we're recommending that people pull out of it. And he said it's also they're criminalizing political opponents. That is what it's doing. It's a way of criminalizing political opponents in order to put the people in that they want to have in power.
Well, criminalizing the president of Ivory Coast, criminalizing
right.
Mr. Kurunziza, That is their goal. They did this with, of course, with President Assad of Syria.
Right.
I noticed today in the media that Human Rights Watch issued a very important declaration to those negotiating a peace settlement in Syria that you can't give there can't be any amnesty for people charged with war crimes. Well, actually, you know, if you can get a peace settlement and you're negotiating, yes, you can. That is not the business of Human Rights Watch or Amnesty or anybody else. Throughout the history of every country on the earth, there have been such agreements. So,
right.
But they want the ability to arrest and charge, of course, all these leaders like Gbagbo.
I think what they should be asked these people is, so then should all every one of the people in the apartheid regime never be amnestied? Of course, they were all amnestied because that was the truth and reconciliation
yes.
approach. In other words, they have a double standard, some of these NGOs.
An absolutely double standard. Now, let's underline that. Did they affirm, or did they just indicate that they are considering withdrawing, or are they recommending withdrawal from the ICC?
What I understand is the African Union is recommending withdrawal from the ICC. He very much supports that.
Yeah.
So,
well, we follow
it may be a big step. You know, because there are probably people who do not want to withdraw it because. For various reasons, but it was a big decision, and of course, it was the president of Kenya who was really pushing that. And
he was one of those who ended up. He was in an election, and a foreign body accused him of crimes, and he actually cooperated, but found that they were disrupting. They wanted him to go and appear in a court in Europe while he's trying to. Run for the presidency of his own country.
Exactly.
And that's when they developed a bad taste for that. I notice, and this is very – I'm really glad all this is being talked about because he has a political opponent in his country. And today he is denouncing the AU for failure to send troops to Burundi, and he's denouncing the AU for this position on the ICC because this is one of those – politicians who hoped to benefit from the removal of Kenyatta as
right.
president. He wanted the Europeans to lock up Kenyatta so that he could become the leader of Kenya.
Exactly.
Much to the, you know, the friend, London would have been happy with that.
Burundian position, we didn't talk about it this time, but when they opposed in December the deployment of troops by the African Union, they said, this will not go over. He says, this was done in the Ivory Coast, and what it means is overthrowing the government. And I think it's very appropriate when we see what's going on now in The Hague, mm-hmm. a trial for the first time of a former head of state, Laurent Gbagbo, and it just started up last week. And mm-hmm. it's a Canadian guy who is the prosecutor.
Mm-hmm. And incidentally, all the on this point of they are only prosecuting Africans, the fact is that that's what the evidence of the matter is. There have been no other significant, that I'm aware of, individuals charged except Africans since the beginning of the ICC.
Exactly. And Anyway, good interview, and they want to make it known. They want to make this position known and how well grounded the position of the African Union is. It responds to principles of sovereignty and democracy, and they're very, very thrilled with this decision.
One other detail, I think you're aware of I saw an interview today with the spokesperson for the government of Zimbabwe, and they asked him, well, isn't this a shocking development? And he said, no, not at all. He said, if you actually look closely at the procedures of the African Union, you will notice that there are regional groupings, and we have an East African Community group of states. And he said they have not recommended that there be an intervention. And if there was going to be, this argument was going to be made, they would have to be the first ones to take it up.
Right.
He's sort of like the guy who, you know, is reminding everybody that there are rules. And,
right.
and you don't just get to organize a vigilante group and get a rope. There are actually rules.
Right.
And I was impressed that was coming from Zimbabwe. By the way, Robert Mugabe was stepping down today, wasn't he, over the weekend, as he had the position, I think, of the presidency.
Yeah.
And he got a standing ovation. Is that right?
That's what I heard. I heard that, too. So
I lived and worked in Tanzania, and I know this. I never heard a word against him, actually.
No.
And every time I saw a picture of any of the leaders who were around him, they were holding his hand. So,
yeah, exactly.
There seemed to be a lot of respect.
It's quite true, and I do think that this point about actually getting the information from the people who are concerned is probably one of the biggest shortcomings of our media, and that's saying very politely. In other words, instead of giving them a chance to defend what they're saying, what's going on, let people weigh it themselves. Everything gets interpreted by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and other observers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's again one of the little founding principles of the United Nations is that there be mutual respect between leaders and states, and there's not the super guy and then the little guy. It's supposed to be everybody is treated with respect. Robin, we're very grateful that you've updated us on a story which is Burundi has become more and more a subject of editorials and sensational journalism here.
Yeah.
So it's very important that we note what happened over the weekend at the African Union, and we thank you very, very much.
Oh, thanks for calling. I mean, they have succeeded for the time being. I mean, there will be other attempts, but in pushing back an attempt to overthrow a legitimate government. And that's a very good sign.
This is Black History Month. That is something to celebrate. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All
Bye.
Right. Are you listening to the Taylor Report? You can find us at facebook.com/ The Taylor Report. I'm saying that so that I'll learn how to say it, which is Facebook.com/ The Taylor Report. And most of our programs will be up on by Thursday, but 3 days after this show. And if you want to here, the previous programs. We also have a website, taylor-report.com, where we have reprint articles and have original material, and also the programs going for years back. And now I tell you again that tomorrow, Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock at the New Visions United Church, 24 Main Street in West Hamilton, Zafar Bengash and Phil Taylor, I know him personally, are going to be talking on Crimes of Empire, Why is the Middle East the Way That It Is? It's February 2nd, Tuesday, 7 p.m. And I mentioned before we're going to be talking in a few minutes with the executive director of Black Agenda Report, and Mr. Glenn Ford, who has been writing also about these matters that I was just speaking with Robin Philpott about, such as Burundi, Rwanda, and the African Union. And we're going to we'll be asking him about the presidential election and some of the other issues. We'll take up the matter of Flint. If you at the Black Agenda Report, you will find some terrific articles. They've been focused on that matter. I want to do a bit of on Hollywood. I have to say, I've told listeners, and I will repeat, you must see, if you can, the movie Trumbo. And it is a terrific film, and it is, nobody gets shot, nobody drives a car off a cliff, and trains don't collide. And all that happens is that you see a great human drama, the center of which is the great Hollywood writer Dalton Trumbo. But since it is Black History Month, I want to say that I did have a little, what's the word? I thought there was a glitch in the film. And that is that when Trumbo arrives in the story, arrives in Kentucky, Ashland, Kentucky, to do his time in prison, when he's introduced into the prison population, he is put in touch with a Black prisoner who is in a supervising position, and he berates Trumbo about racism, and it was a very poignant moment. It's beautifully acted. It's certainly true, the words that came from the actor. But I thought to myself that there was something a little, it went clunk, and here's why. That was 1951 USA, or 52, that period. Very important to remember, particularly in Black History Month, America was a segregated country. Particularly in the south of the Mason-Dixon line, it was legal separation enforced and violently enforced, complete with militias who hanged people. And I said to myself, I don't think this happened, couldn't happen, because the prisoners were, there was only the one Black prisoner, and I doubted it. So I looked it up anyway. The film is based on a book, which you should also get and read. It's a terrific book by Bruce Cook called Trumbo. And so I checked out the chapter where he discusses this. Now, interestingly enough, Trumbo says, in directly speaking to the subject of the Black prisoner whose name I think was Brooks, that Brooks was a fellow prisoner, and they had to do manual labor. And that Brooks actually, seeing that Trumbo was, stereotype intellectual, wasn't going to be the one able to do some of the heavy work, and he helped Trumbo. That's what he did. He helped him. And he, of course, because it was segregated America, he was in a terrible situation himself. And Trumbo says that Brooks told him that when he entered that prison, no one ever spoke to him, Brooks, and contrary-wise, he never spoke to them. But he did speak to Trumbo, probably because he'd heard about roughly who Trumbo might be, and I'm sure Trumbo approached him. I don't know why they decided to configure it with putting him in charge, because it's not 1950s America. This is what they call pre-1964 America. 1964 was when we began to get the Voting Rights Act and basically the civil rights legislation. And Brooks was therefore not actually appropriately pictured. Further to that, Trumbull says about that man that he was extremely bitter, and he told Trumbull that when I get out of here, I'm going to pack up and leave, and I'm not saying anything to anybody. And Trumbull said he remembered the morning when he saw him packing up to leave, and he watched him, and no one said anything. He didn't say anything. That is Brooks. And he said he watched him go out the front gate, and he said he never looked back. So if I was on the production team, I would have said, please put that in the film, will you? Let's do that. And please also remind us that when Trumbull was in that prison, it was in the time of segregated America. And further, by the way, don't show him, as they did, sitting with a group of white prisoners cheering when John Wayne gives a big speech about how great the country is and how they're all going to fight and die for it, etc. That did not happen to Brooks. Brooks did not – that's not him. So you're violating the guy's identity. I don't think it's very helpful. I really wish they had not done that part. Now, by the way, I'm not trying to – I don't want you to say, well, I'm not going to go to that film. No, I'm just – it's a footnote. But it's – we got to keep it 100, as Larry Wilmore likes to say. Keep it 100. Now, there is another matter I thought worth mentioning, and it's apropos of last week's discussion of the movie Revenant. Did I get that right? It's a new word to me. But anyway, it's the one with DiCaprio. That falsely portrayed Native Americans. It falsely portrayed certainly the French, who were there to greet all these Americans when they came out west, and including also the English. The French were already there. But it should remind us that the guy in the movie, Toussaint Charbonneau, is portrayed as a very ugly villain. He lived a long life. He worked for many, many people, companies and whatnot, highly respected translator. And he did all these frontier things that are so admirable. They make the American frontiersmen. Toussaint did all those things. But he was part of the Lewis and Clark expedition, which Americans are all so proud of. And there's a detail. Toussaint was there with Lewis and Clark, making them stay safe, along with his wife, Sacagawea. And again, there are statues of her now all over the place. But her husband was this very Toussaint that they make into a villain in the film. But there was another man who was part of the 33 Americans who made it to the Pacific coast. And his name was York, and he was an African-American, and he was a slave. He belonged to Clark. Lewis and Clark had a slave. And he went through the whole expedition, and typical of an effort of that kind, he was very much treated as an equal because 33 people need one another. And when they reached the Pacific coast, they had to make a decision about finding a secure place to make a camp, and they took a vote. And it's important to learn or know that Sacagawea, the woman, a Shoshone, she voted, and her husband Toussaint Charbonneau voted, and the slave York voted. All the people in the party were treated as though they were equal weight. They became like a family or a company. I think it's important to note that. And in the future, I'm not going to let anybody tell me about the Lewis and Clark expedition if they're not going to tell me about York. Incidentally, when the Native Americans met that party of Lewis and Clark, they said, "Can we see this man, York?" Because they knew he wasn't one of those Europeans. They wanted to meet him. And so he was kind of an important feature, whatever, and I can't tell you what the interaction was, but he was of great interest to the various native leaders that Lewis and Clark encountered. Anyway, this is the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. And again, I want you to know that, I want to make sure I announce this. Bette Satoun at 7 p.m. on the 3rd, that week, this coming Wednesday, is going to have a book discussion, Sharon and My Mother-in-Law, which is a title you didn't expect to hear. That's Wednesday, 7 p.m. And on February the 4th, Thursday, 7 p.m., there's going to be The Shifting Narrative, a conversation with Zarak Nawaz, creator of The Little House on the Prairie, a very successful television show that's going to be, and she will be interviewed at, that's at 7 p.m., Bette Satoun, February the 4th. And on the 5th, there's going to be a film, Allah and Me and Everyone Else, and it's directed by a documentary filmmaker, Kyoko Yokoma. That's February the that'd be February the 5th, 7 p.m. And again, tomorrow in Hamilton at 24 Main Street, New Visions United Church, Zafar Benkash and Phil Taylor are going to be talking about Crimes of Empire. Why is the Middle East the way it is? So we'll take a break, and we will come back and speak to Glenn Ford.